This podcast brought to you by the English Department at Florida State University.
And without further ado, we're going to bring up my good friend, Amy Denham. Yay!
Yay! Are we good? Okay. I read a few weeks ago and I stood on my toes the whole time, so I'm going to make sure it's at the right height. Okay. Tonight I have the honor of introducing one of FSU's most accomplished writers and fiction instructors, Robert Olin Butler. When I took Bob's workshop in the spring of my second year, we began the semester by reading his craft fiction book, From Where You Dream. This was the point at which I was introduced to the concept which Bob refers to as yearning in literary fiction. Bob's theory of writing is an intuitive one of the senses. It is comprised of the minute details we choose or do not choose to fixate on in writing the stories of our own lives. It is through this subconscious ordering, this unyielding picking and choosing that takes place in our minds as we attempt to organize a haphazard world, that the circumstances of the human condition are actively rendered. In From Where You Dream, Bob writes, "Artists are intensely aware of the chaos implied by the moment-to-moment sensual experience of human beings on this planet. But they also paradoxically have an intuition that beyond the chaos there is meaning. There is a deep and abiding order." Bob's writing is inherently concerned with the internal construction of identity and is written from the vaults of memory and imagination, restructured and reformed as art. This is, as Bob will frequently remind you in class, not a process of thinking, ideas, or abstractions. Rather, it is a truly artistic and instinctual process, a rendering of the world not as it was or as it happened, but as it seems, as it feels. A long-serving fiction writer on FSU's faculty, Bob also holds the distinction of being one of the most prolific and revered. In addition to his 16 and counting novel career, numerous short story collections, one of which, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, was the recipient of a Pulitzer Prize, and one book on fiction craft. His work has appeared in such places as The New Yorker, Esquire, Harper's, The Atlantic, GQ, and Zoetrope, and tonight, in the ears of the patrons of Tallahassee's own warehouse. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Robert Olin Butler.
Thank you so much, Amy. This reading will not be what it could be at its best because I had planned on having the sound of running water pumped in here to the during my reading as the background. But since you can't pee, I thought that would be cruel to do that. So there'll be no running water sounds. Yeah. I wasn't supposed to read tonight. In fact, I was going to skip this year, Perfume River, which I actually read from a little bit last year because Empire of the Night didn't show up in time, and it's now out there in the world. But I'd hoped to actually sponsor in my longtime, very dear friend John Wood, who's a remarkable poet. If you were around here 14 or 15 years ago, you heard him read. And when I asked him to come down, he was, and his wonderful wife Carol, they are extraordinarily and bravely dealing with something that at that point, it was still possible for him to come. And indeed, he is still extraordinary behind the podium, even now, and one-on-one in conferences. But John is 75 and is in the beginnings of Alzheimer's. And unfortunately, in midsummer, it was clear that he really couldn't really travel. And so Kelly and I are going to go visit him next month out in Vermont, where he is. But he's an extraordinary man, a brilliant mind. And John wanted me to be sure and say, in telling you this, that he lives in Saxton's River, Vermont, which has a population of about 500. But there's a major hospital I'm forgetting the university now, the major university up there in Vermont, but their local his local doctor turns out to be an Alzheimer's expert, so he's in good care. But I want you to keep a warm, good thought for a truly great poet. And so tonight, I'm going to start by reading a couple of John's poems to you. And then I'm going to read from my own work, but I'm going to read from the book that is dedicated to John Wood. Not in any acknowledgement, it is the sole dedication of the book. And the book is A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. My Pulitzer book was actually dedicated to John Wood, who, at the time I wrote the book, was my colleague at McNeese State University, my closest friend, and my kind of artistic soulmate. He's a wonderful man. And so, first of all, his poems. Two of them. I won't try to explain them to you because, I mean, in terms of what his characteristics are, you will hear it. And the first one is called The Bitter Part of Heaven. They're all there. The man killed by the pinball machine, the girl who laughed to death, the dieting boy who choked on a tapeworm wiggling up in search of cakes and steak, and of course, the babies. The ones, the ants, the mad chefs, the anacondas, piranhas, and the threshing machines got. This is heaven's bitter part, where all the dead from the Inquirer's pages are housed whole again but in anger at irony and excess. Their eyeballs have turned right again. Hacked heads have found their proper bodies. The mountains of dog food ground by angry sons or husbands have reconstituted. But they brood and play out of tune, pluck the wrong strings, and frown at those no tabloid ever eulogized. It is hard for them being here, even though it's heaven. Things having gone quite wrong once. Irony having intruded into an ordinary afternoon like a steering wheel through the chest. Some even say they would have done things differently. Things like sex, things like that, had they known it would have come to this, a joke's butt reassembled with wings. Gowns of gossamer and gold stitching, but a body smooth as a mannequin's. A feeling of having been betrayed. In other neighborhoods, others who lived in fear of surprise, waited on infected toenails and meteors, the doors of saunas and freezers, and then died boringly old and on time, unable even to be surprised that there was no surprise, fumble through their songs like beginners, though some have been at it for centuries. They are distracted and equally bitter, would have done things differently too. Of course, there are some areas where hymns herald out of every window, but there are few houses there on those spare streets. John, as extraordinary and erudite as he is, by the way, he's written half a dozen books about daguerreotypes and autochromes. He's an expert in the history of photography, and even now, or even until this summer, lectures at Harvard on photography. But his erudition is always cut by, his sensibility and his love of pop culture. And I thought I'd read a poem based on something I suspect most of us have, even those of you who are too young for the original, probably have seen it on Nick at Night. Mayberry, you know, the Andy Griffith Show. Well, This poem's called Opie and the Apples. And it, by the way, opens with a kind of a rendering of an episode of the Andy Griffith Show that you might have missed. When the new kid moved to Mayberry and didn't want to go fishing with Opie, and they called him Dopey because he said he'd rather fish than steal apples, and Opie asked Andy if he could fight the new kid because he'd called him names, and Andy said no, and how that just wouldn't be right neighborly, and how Opie would just have to find something to like about the new kid. And so Opie stole some apples too and got in trouble, and it was a terrible mess. And Aunt Bee cried and cried, and Barney wanted to take Opie to the woodshed, but Andy had a big powwow with old Ope, and Opie just finally beat the shit out of the new kid, who then went fishing with Opie and decided Aunt Bee, whom he earlier had said looked like a big-titted warthog, was real pretty. And that his snooty mother, who had never fried chicken, was a selfish snob. And Aunt Bee's fried chicken was better than anything he'd ever eaten. And his father was just too rich and busy to love a little kid whose single but very large tear finally made that father see he needed to take him fishing with Opie and Andy, and made his mother run to Aunt Bee's kitchen begging for her recipe. So when all that happened, on that typical Mayberry day, I wondered what Andy did when he got horny. And if Barney dreamed of being locked in a cell with Andy, and no one would let them out, and there was a big shower nozzle, and Andy took lots of showers, because he said a man ought to stay clean, and Barney felt happy. Happier even than when he patrolled the streets. And if Floyd ever raised the price of a haircut or nicked an ear, and if there were high school kids in Mayberry, boys who reached into the sweaters of girls and girls who ran their hands over the tight zippers of boys, and if apples ever rotted in Mayberry, and how loud the preachers got when they talked of apples and Eve and disobedience, and if when Opie learned to masturbate, he would think of this day on which he stole apples and got in trouble, and Aunt Bee cried and cried, because she knew he'd be at himself in a few years, and that socks and sheets would show his shame, and there would be nothing, nothing she could say to him, and that pimples would rise on his face, and that he would find his hand in sweaters and his tongue deep into the cleft of the world's imperfections. And she wept and tore chunks from her hair and gnawed her knuckles, knowing there was not grace enough even here, even in Mayberry, to seal the thighs of Eve. So, that's John Wood. They're both from his first book of poems, first winner of the Iowa Poetry Prize, his first prize, it was along the way in the prize history. It was called In Primary Light, and I'd recommend you seeking it out and reading it. Okay, now, as I said, I dedicated A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain to John, and I talked to him, and I think he opted for this story, Mr. Green, which is my other parrot story. Coincidentally, was read at Symphony Space in New York for Selected Shorts just last year with Richard Ford. It was a tribute to Richard Ford that evening, and he asked that this story be done with his. He had put it in a grant anthology. So it keeps coming back to life now and then. So this is Mr. Green from A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, one of John's favorites for John Wood. I am a Catholic, the daughter of a Catholic mother and father, and I do not believe in the worship of my ancestors, especially in the form of a parrot. My father's parents died when he was very young, and he became a Catholic in an orphanage run by nuns in Hanoi. My mother's mother was a Catholic, but her father was not. And, like many Vietnamese, he was a believer in what Confucius taught about ancestors. I remember him taking me by the hand while my parents and my grandmother were sitting under a banana tree in the yard, and he said, "Let's go talk with Mr. Green." He led me into the house, and he touched his lips with his forefinger to tell me that this was a secret. Mr. Green was my grandfather's parrot, and I loved talking with him, but we passed Mr. Green's roost in the front room. Mr. Green said, "Hello, kind sir," but we didn't even answer him. My grandfather took me to the back of his house, to a room that my mother had said was private, that she had yanked me away from when I once had tried to look. It had a bead curtain at the door, and we passed through it, and the beads rustled like tall grass. The room was dim, lit by candles, and it smelled of incense, and my grandfather stood before a little shrine with flowers and a smoking incense bowl and two brass candlesticks, and between them a photo of a man in a Chinese Mandarin hat. "That's my father," he said, nodding toward the photo. "He lives here." And they let go of my hand and touched my shoulder. "Say a prayer for my father." The face in the photo was tilted a little to the side and was smiling faintly, like he just asked me a question and he was waiting for an answer that he expected to like. I knelt before the shrine, as I did at Mass, and I said the only prayer I knew by heart, the Lord's Prayer. But as I prayed, I was conscious of my grandfather. I even peeked at him as he stepped to the door and parted the beads and looked toward the front of the house. Then he returned and stood beside me, and I finished my prayer as I listened to the beads rustling into silence behind us. When I said amen aloud, my grandfather knelt beside me and leaned near and whispered, "Your father is doing a terrible thing. If he must be Catholic, that's one thing. But he has left the spirits of his ancestors to wander for eternity in loneliness." It was hard for me to believe that my father was doing something as terrible as this. But it was harder for me to believe that my grandfather, who was even older than my father, could be wrong. My grandfather explained about the spirit world, how the souls of our ancestors continue to need love and attention and devotion. Given these things, they will share in our lives, and they will bless us and even warn us about disasters in our dreams. But if we neglect the souls of our ancestors, they will become lost and lonely and will wander around in the kingdom of the dead, no better off than a warrior killed by his enemy and left unburied in a rice paddy to be eaten by blackbirds of prey. When my grandfather told me about the birds plucking out the eyes of the dead and about the possibility of our own ancestors, our own family, suffering just like that if we ignore them, I said, "Don't worry, grandfather. I will always say prayers for you and make offerings for you, even if I'm a Catholic." I thought this would please my grandfather, but he just shook his head sharply, like he was mad at me, and he said, "Not possible." "I can," I said. Then he looked at me, and I guess he realized that he'd spoken harshly. He tilted his head slightly and smiled a little smile, just like his father in the picture. But what he said wasn't something to smile about. "You are a girl," he said, "so it's not possible for you to do it alone, Only a son can oversee the worship of his ancestors. I felt a strange thing inside me, a recoiling, like I'd stepped barefoot on a slug. How can you recoil from your own body? And so I began to cry. My grandfather patted me and kissed me and said it was all right, but it wasn't all right for me. I wanted to protect my grandfather's soul, but it wasn't in my power. I was a girl. We waited together before the shrine. When I'd stopped crying, we went back to the front room, and my grandfather bowed to his parrot and said, "Hello, kind sir." And Mr. Green said, "Hello, kind sir." And even though I loved the parrot, I would not speak to him that day because he was a boy and I wasn't. This was in our town, which was on the bank of the Red River just south of Hanoi. We left that town not long after. I was 7 years old, and I remember my grandfather arguing with my parents. I was sleeping on a mat at the back of our house, and I woke up and I heard voices, and my grandfather said, "Not possible." The words chilled me, but then I listened more closely, and I knew they were discussing the trip we were about to go on. Everyone was very frightened and excited. There were many families in our little town who were planning to leave. They had even taken the bell out of the church tower to carry with them. We were all Catholics, but Grandfather did not have the concerns of the Catholics. He was concerned about the spirits of his ancestors. This was the place where they were born and died and were buried. He was afraid that they would not make the trip. "What then?" he cried. And later, he spoke of the people of the South and how they would hate us being from the North. "What then?" he said. Mr. Green says that too. "What then?" he has cried to me 1,000 times, 10,000 times, in the past 16 years. Parrots can live for 100 years, and though I could not protect my dead grandfather's soul, I could take care of his parrot. When my grandfather died in Saigon in 1972, he made sure that Mr. Green came to me. I was 24 then, and newly married, and I still loved Mr. Green. He would sit on my shoulder and take the top of my ear in his beak, a beak that could crush the hardest shell, and he would hold my ear with the greatest gentleness and touch me with his tongue. I have brought Mr. Green with me to the United States of America. And in the long summers here in New Orleans and in the warm springs and falls and even in many days of our mild winters, he sits on my screened-in back porch near the door and he speaks in the voice of my grandfather. When he wants to get onto my shoulder and go with me into the community garden, he says, "What then?" And when I first come to him in the morning, he says, "Hello, kind sir." He loves me. That is, I am the only person who can go near him without his attempting to draw blood. But he loved my grandfather before me, and there are times when he seems to hold the spirit of my grandfather and all his knowledge. Mr. Green sits on my shoulder and presses close to my head, and he repeats the words that he has heard from my husband and my children. My children even teach him English words. He says all these things, but without any feeling. The Vietnamese words of my grandfather, however, come out powerfully, like someone very strong is inside him. And whenever he speaks with my grandfather's voice, Mr. Green's eyes dilate and contract over and over, which is a parrot's display of happiness. Yesterday, I tried to give him some drops that the veterinarian prescribed for him, and Mr. Green said, "Not possible." And even though he is sick, his eyes showed how pleased he was to defy me. When we all lived in Saigon at last, my grandfather discovered the bird market on Hom Nghi Street, and he would take me there. Actually, in the street market of Hom Nghi, there were animals of all kinds, dogs and monkeys and rabbits and turtles and even wildcats. But when my grandfather took my hand and said to me, "Come, little one," and we walked down Trung Dao, where our house was, and we came to Hom Nghi, he always took me to the place with the birds. The canaries were the most loved by everyone who came to the market. My grandfather sang with them. They all hopped to the side of their cages that was closest to my grandfather, and he whistled and hummed and even sang words, songs from the north that he sang quite low so that only the birds could hear. He did not want the people of Saigon to realize he was from the north, and the canaries all opened their mouths, and the air filled with their sounds, their throats ruffling and puffing. And I looked at my grandfather's throat to see if it moved the way the throats of these birds moved. It did not move at all. His skin was slack there. And all the times I saw him charm the birds, I never saw his throat move, like he didn't really mean the sounds he made. The people all laughed when they saw what he could do, and they said my grandfather was a wizard, but he would just ignore them. The canaries seemed to be his favorite birds on Hom Nghi, though he spent time with them all. The dark-plumed ones, the magpies, and the blackbirds were always singing on their own, especially the blackbirds with their orange beaks. My grandfather came near the blackbirds, and they were gabbling among themselves, and he frowned at them, like they were fools to be content only with their own company. They did not need him to prompt their songs. He growled at them, "You're just a bunch of old women." And we moved on to the doves that were big-eyed and quiet, and he cooed at them, and he told them how pretty they were, and we looked at the moorhens pecking at the bottoms of their cages like chickens, and the cranes with their wonderful necks curling and stretching. We visited all the birds, and my grandfather loved them. And the first time we went to Hom Nghi, we ended up at the cages crowded with sparrows. He bent near their chattering. And I liked these birds very much. They were small, and their eyes were bright. And even though the birds were crowded, they were always in motion, hopping and fluffing up and shaking themselves like my vain friends. I was a quiet little girl, but I too would sometimes look at myself in a mirror and primp and puff myself up, even as in public I tried to hold myself apart a little bit from the other girls. I was surprised and delighted that first day when my grandfather motioned to the bird seller and began to point at sparrows, and the merchant reached into the cage and caught one bird after another, and he put them all into a cardboard box. My grandfather bought 12 birds, and they did not fly away as they sat in the box. "Why aren't they flying?" I asked. "Their wings are clipped," my grandfather said. This was all right with me. They clearly weren't in any pain, and they could still hop, and they would never fly away from me. I wouldn't even need a cage for my vain little friends. I'm sure that my grandfather knew what I was thinking, but he said nothing. When we got home, he gave me the box and told me to take the birds to show my mother. I found her on the back stoop slicing vegetables. I showed her the box, and she said that grandfather was wonderful. She set the box down and told me to stay with her. I could help her. I crouched beside her and waited, and I could hear the chattering of the sparrows from the box. We'd always kept chickens and ducks and geese. Some of them were pecking around near us, even as I crouched there with my mother. I knew that we ate those animals, but for some reason, Hom Nghi seemed like a different place altogether, and the sparrows could only be for song and friendship. But finally, my mother finished cutting the vegetables, and she reached into the box and drew out a sparrow, its feet dangling from the bottom of her fist and its head poking out of the top. I looked at its face, and I knew it was a girl. And my mother said, "This is the way it's done." And she fisted her other hand around the sparrow's head, and she twisted. I don't remember how long it took me to get used to this. But I was always drift away when my grandfather went to the sparrow cages in Hamye. I did not like his face when he bought them. It seemed the same as when he cooed at the doves or sang at the canaries. But I must have decided that it was all part of growing up, of becoming a woman like my mother. For it was she who killed them, after all. And she taught me to do this thing. And I wanted to be just like her. And I twisted the necks of the sparrows, and I plucked their feathers. And we roasted them and ate them. And my grandfather would take a deep breath after the meal, and his eyes would close in pleasure. There were parrots, too, on Hamye. They all looked very much like Mr. Green. They were the color of breadfruit leaves with a little yellow on their throat. My grandfather chose one bird each time and cocked his head at it, copying the angle of the bird's head. And my grandfather said, "Hello," or "What's your name?" things he never said to Mr. Green. The parrots on Hamye did not talk to my grandfather, though once one of them made a sound like the horns of the little cream and blue taxis that rushed past in the streets. But they never spoke any words, and my grandfather took care to explain to me that these parrots were too recently captured to have learned anything. He said that they were probably not as smart as Mr. Green either, but one day they would speak. Once, after explaining this, he leaned near me and motioned to a parrot that was digging for mites under his wing and said, "That bird will still be alive and speaking to someone when you have grown to be an old woman and have died and are buried in the ground." I am 41 years old now. I go each day to the garden on the bank of the bayou that runs through this place they call Versailles. It is part of New Orleans, but it is far from the center of the town. It is full of Vietnamese who once came from the north. My grandfather never saw the United States. I don't know what he would think. But I come from his garden each day, and I crouch in the rich earth, and I wear my straw hat and my black pantaloons, and I grow lettuce and collards and turnip greens and mint, and my feet, which were once quite beautiful, grow coarse. My family likes the things I bring to the table. Sometimes Mr. Green comes with me to this garden. He rides on my shoulder, and he stays there for a long time, often imitating the cardinals, the sharp ricochet sound they make. Then finally, Mr. Green climbs down my arms and drops to the ground, and he waddles about in the garden. And when he starts to bite off the stalk of a plant, I cry, not possible. And he looks at me like he is angry. I dare to use his own words. It is his that his first master is against him. I always bring twigs with me, and I throw them, throw him one chew on, and neither of us has to bow down. I have always tried to preserve his dignity. He is at least 50 years older than me. My grandfather was 18 when he himself took Mr. Green on a trail in the Highlands with his father. So Mr. Green is quite old. And old people sometimes lose their understanding of things around them. It is not strange that a few weeks ago, Mr. Green began to pluck his feathers out.
I went to the veterinarian when it became clear what was happening. A great bear had appeared on Green's chest. I had feathers put on his foot of his perch. So I watched him one afternoon get through the window. He sat on his perch beside the door of the porch. And he pulled twelve feathers from his chest, one at a time. And he felt with his tongue and dropped to the floor. I came out on the church of the porch. And he squawked at me, as if he was doing something private. And I should have known better than to intrude. I sat down on the porch, and he stopped. I took Mr. Green to the veterinarian, and he said he would do this. It may be because he lost his lack of vitamin mineral, but more often the reason is for his bird. I tried to convince myself that this is what it meant. When Mr. Green stopped plucking his feathers as soon as I appeared on the porch. Keep him busy, the doctor said. So I got Mr. Green a new climbing tree with lots of fresh barbed peel, and I spent more time with him. I took him to the garden when he didn't ask me to go. And I brought my sewing and even did some of my cooking, the preparation of foods out on the porch while I did these household things. I talked to him. It was just idle chatter. But there were plenty of words. And often Mr. Green looked sharply as I spoke. And I could hear how my sound sounded, chattering away like a blackbird. But I felt driven to do something for him. He was old and sick, and I felt I had to do something. My grandfather took 6 months to die, and he lay in a bed on the top floor of our house, and Mr. Green was always on a perch beside him. I remember a wind chime at the window. It was made of brass, and I've never had a wind chime in my own home, because when I hear one, another sound always comes with it, with the deep rattling cough of my grandfather. I would visit him in his room with my mother, and once he called me back as we were about to leave. I came to him, and my mother had gone on out the door, and I could hear her talking rapidly with my grandmother. My grandfather motioned me to come very near, and he twisted his body in the bed. His face crumpled in pain as he did it, but he forced himself because he wanted to tell me a secret. I leaned close to him. "Do you hear them talking?" he said. He nodded toward the door, and he obviously meant my mother and grandmother. "Yes," I said. He frowned. "How foolish they sound, chattering and yammering, all the women sound like that. You don't want to grow up sounding like these foolish women, do you?" I did not know how to answer his question. I wanted very much to be like my mother. And when my grandfather said this, I felt a recoiling begin inside me and the tears begin to rise. But my mother called my name at that moment, and I did not have to find an answer to my grandfather's question. I turned my back on him and ran across the room without saying a word. As I got to the door, however, Mr. Green cried, "What then?" And it sounded as if he had actually finished my grandfather's thought. "You will grow up to be a woman. What then?" And maybe he did finish the thought. Parrots are very smart. Mr. Green, in particular, and he knows more than just my grandfather's words. The Buddhists believe in the transmigration of souls, though I suppose it's impossible to transmigrate into some creature that's already alive. But after a few days of angry looks from Mr. Green, when I filled the porch with talk that was intended to save his life, he began to cry, "Not possible," over and over, until I stopped speaking. Perhaps a male voice would have been acceptable to him, but mine was not. And then Mr. Green began to pluck himself once more, even with me sitting there in the room. I went to him when he began to do this, and I said, "Not possible," but he ignored me. He did not even raise his head to look at me, but tore away at his feathers, each one making a faint popping sound as it came out. Then the next day,
he began to cough. I knew the cough well, but I took Mr. Green to the veterinarian, and he told me what I expected, that the cough was not the bird's. This was a sound he was imitating. "Did someone in your household recently have a cold or the flu?" the doctor said. "It is my grandfather," I said. On the last visit to my grandfather's room, he began to cough. My mother went to him, and he waved her away. She backed off, and I came forward, wanting to help him. He was sitting up now and hunched over, and the cough rattled deep inside his chest. And then there was a sudden silence, and I drew nearer, thinking that my step forward had actually helped. But my grandfather lifted his face, and his eyes were very sad, and I knew he was disappointed. My brothers were not yet born. And I held my breath so that this silence would go on. But the sound raked up from his chest and filled the room again. This morning I went to the back porch, and Mr. Green was pulling out a feather, and he did not acknowledge me, even to taunt me by calling me sir. He dropped the feather and began to pluck another from beneath his left wing. His chest was naked now, and the skin looked as slack as my grandfather's throat. I stood before him, and I offered my arm for him to come and sit on my shoulder. Yesterday he had said, "Not possible," but today he said nothing. He dropped a feather and leaned over and bit me hard on the arm. I bled, but I did not move my arm. And he looked at me. His eyes were steady in their sadness, fully dilated as if he was considering all of this. I pushed my arm to him again, and he knew that he had no choice, so he climbed on, but he did not go to my shoulder. I held my arm aloft and carried Mr. Green outside. The sun had still not burned the fog off the bayou, and I went straight into the garden. My feet were bare, like a child's, and the earth was soft and wet, and I crouched there. And I quickly reached to Mr. Green and grasped him at the chest, lifted him and caught him with my other hand before he could struggle. His wings were pinned, and he was bigger in my hands than I had ever imagined. But a Vietnamese woman is experienced in these things, and Mr. Green did not have a chance even to make a sound as I laid him on his side, pinned him with my knee, slid my hands up, and wrung his neck. I pray for the soul of my grandfather. I do not bear him any anger. Sometimes I go to Mass during the week. Versailles has a Catholic church just for the Vietnamese, and the Mass is celebrated in our language. I sit near the back, and I look at the section where all the old women go. They take the Eucharist every day of their lives, and they sit together wearing their traditional dresses and with their hair in scarves rolled up on their heads, and I wonder if that is where I will finally end up, in the old women's section at Mass each day. No one in my church will likely live as long as a parrot. But our Savior lived only 33 years, so maybe it's not important. There were women around Jesus when he died. The two Marys. They couldn't do anything for him, but neither could the men who had all run away.